So tonight's homily is again continuing the chapter by chapter exploration of my newest book, The Three Principles of Oneness. And tonight we're going to explore chapter 5, Personal Experiences of Oneness. Our first reading is by Robert Plant, and our second reading is by Lord Byron. And at my feet, eternity draws ever sweeter plants for me. Oh, who can tell, save he whose heart hath tried? So I'm going to go over some of my personal experiences, but before I do that, I want to add one caveat. There's a good reason why I have hesitated over the years to talk too much about my own personal experiences, especially ones that others might think they have to emulate, or others might feel that if they don't have that same kind of experience, that perhaps they're not, you know, as enlightened, if you will. And that's something I always want to avoid. But I have learned over the decades of practicing and teaching that folks are often very interested in those experiences, and they're interested in the type of suffering that I've gone through and how the practices have helped me. So I wanted to share those because I think that while we can talk about universal themes of oneness, and we can talk about the way within one, which oneness is available to everyone without regard, I also think it's very personal. It's a personal connection. And I would go so far as to say it is a personal relationship. Because even if we talk about oneness in terminology or in conceptualization that kind of goes beyond the personal, you know, and the fancy word for that is transpersonal, it's always very personal to us. And so whatever way within which we experience oneness, it's very personal. So it's from that place that I share these things. When I was a very young boy, I loved visiting my extended relatives at my great-grandmother's home and my great-aunt and uncle lived. And I really loved them all. And it was a very old farmhouse. And we had great times there. They had 12 children. And so there was always a lot of stuff going on. And we used to go over there on the late weeknights, sometimes weekends, and we would watch television together, which was usually Gunsmoke, or if there was a boxing match on. And they had this little tiny black and white TV, and we'd all crowd around it, you know, this throng. And it's good memories. And one of the things that was very interesting is that if you were going to draw water, you had to draw it from a pump because they had a well. And one of the things that you had to do is you had to go out and prime the pump. And by priming the pump, then you would open it up so that it would be drawn out. That water would draw it out to the surface, and then you could take some. And I think of ourselves, our personal beings, as sort of like that pump. We have to be primed. We have to prime the pump. That within us, the deepest, most personal ground of our very being, that is one. That is the true connection. And we all have it within us. And it's available to us, and it's an endless source. It's a well that the water has no end. But we have to prime the pump. Sometimes we'll have experiences, and those experiences will come and go, and they'll fade into memory, and we'll do nothing with them. So I think that two of the things that I'm going to admonish tonight is that you learn to prime the pump. And by that, I mean you study and you understand the concepts and the doctrines and the teachings of oneness. And you engage in the practices of oneness so that your pump is primed. And then when you make contact with the eternal, it will flow forth in you. And you will realize that daily practice is about priming that pump so that every day that everlasting source is available to you. So I'm going to go over the things that I wrote about in my chapter about my personal experiences. Now, I've had a lot of them. And in some ways, you might say that my pump was primed before I was even born. My mother, who is a very deeply religious woman, whenever she found out that she was pregnant with me, one of the things that she did is that she made a vow and an offering of me. She offered me to God, and with the vow that she would raise me in a certain way so that I would become a servant. Sounds like the spirit was moving in our kitchen. So, from a very, very young age, she was doing this. Now, I didn't know this. She didn't tell me about this till I was much older. But that being said, I kind of grew up, you know, very much being supported that way. The thing is, she didn't really have to force me to do it. Like, I loved going to church. Unlike a lot of kids, I loved going to church. And I loved being there. And I loved everything about it. And so for me, from a very early, early age, and I'm talking very little, I felt this calling. And I would find myself feeling this calling when I was in a church, or I would feel this calling whenever I was outdoors, sleeping under the stars in the summer when we lived in New York. And then, of course, I had my big experience at about 6 years of age in a little church in New York. And, you know, most of you have read my book or you've heard me speak about it before. You know, basically, I wandered off into the sacristy after church was over. And the sacristy is a room where the minister keeps the robes and so forth. And I found myself there. I don't really remember it much, but I do remember being there. And I remember going in and smelling incense. And I remember thinking to myself at 6 years of age that this is what I want to do with my life. And I remember later when my mom found me, she wasn't angry with me. She kind of knew that somehow that's where she'd find me. And so, whenever we moved quite frequently, because my father's work, he was an entrepreneur, so we were always kind of moving around. And we lived in another part of New York. And that stage of my life, I remember parts of it. But I remember that I was probably about, well, I couldn't have been more than maybe seven, maybe eight. And I remember that I had this group of gang of kids that would follow me around, and I would take them, you know, to someone's yard and sit and teach them Bible stories. And I would go house to house in the neighborhood sharing the good news and asking if there was anything that I could do for my neighbors. And I was probably about 7, maybe 8. And I put on passion plays. I would get the neighborhood kids together and we'd perform the plays for the adults. And it was a passion play, man. I even had a working cross that I could climb up on and be tied to. So it was all out. And people would. Lots and lots of people would gather. And it was probably my first experience of actually doing that or sort of living out that call. And my mother was thrilled. She was thrilled with it. So this is something for me that is just, I don't know how to compare it to someone else's experience because it's so personal to me. But I have always felt connected to oneness. And whether I called it God, or I called it spirit, it didn't really matter. I always felt connected. And so I would have these different experiences, and my first intimation of what I would call mindfulness came about whenever I was very little. I don't know what age I was. I could have been somewhere in that range between 5 and 8. And we would go back, and we moved back to Hollidaysburg, Pennsylvania. And my grandfather, who I adored, to me, he was, I practically worshipped him. He meant so much to me. He and I would spend a lot of time together, and he had this great downstairs in the basement. He had converted it, and he was a composer, and he built guitars, and he did different things like that, and so it was a place that I would play a lot in. And he had this coal-burning furnace, and so I would play down there. And sometimes I would be a little bit afraid of that coal-burning furnace because it was sort of like, when it was on, it was sort of like, it seemed like a monster to me. So I found myself sometimes being scared of that. And I remember one time I was down there playing, and I guess there was a power outage. And it was dark, it was evening, and everything went dark, went pitch black. And the only thing I could still see to my mind's eye, is I could see underneath the steps, there was another little space, another room, and then the furnace was back here. And I remember looking at that furnace, and it sounded like it was breathing. And I was scared. I was really scared. And by that time, my grandfather, when I would stay over on weekend nights with him, we'd watch Schiller Theater. And so I got to see Frankenstein and Dracula and the Wolfman and all the classic Universal monsters. And so I very much loved them. And I was a big fan of the Munsters, and I had a Herman Munster puppet. So anyhow, this happens, and I'm really scared. And I can't see. So I don't know where to go. And then something inside of me, like a little voice inside of me said, if you're a monster, you won't be afraid. If you're a monster, you won't be afraid. And so, I suddenly made myself into Frankenstein's monster. And I put my hands out, and I started moving in the darkness, making grunting noises, you know, how Boris Karloff would do, rah, you know, making that noises. And the fear swept away from me. And it wasn't long after that that my grandfather, was trying to get the light, came, opened the door, and yelled down and said, hey, are you all right? And he saw me walking, you know, the lights were turned back on. Figured, oh yeah, you're okay. you figured it out. So that was my first intimation of mindfulness. The other one I mentioned in there is when I hit my head really hard on a table that I was playing under. And when we lived in Pennsylvania, in Hollysburg, and again, I was a very little boy. And I really banged it hard, so hard that it bled. It was on those tables that had those parts that pulled apart, and they had all these dangerous, sharp things under the table. And so, of course, that's where we would play as kids. And I remember I loved Lincoln Logs, so I'd play with my Lincoln Logs under there, and I was infatuated with Abraham Lincoln. That was another person I learned about and read about, and I was just infatuated with Abraham Lincoln. And I remember I had lots of pennies and so forth and so on. So I reached up and banged my head. And I mean, it hurt so bad. I can still feel it when I think about it or tell the story. And I remember even feeling something wet. And like I say, I was somewhere in that range between 5 and 8. And I was going to start screaming, and I felt myself tears welling up. And then I looked down at the floor, and I saw a penny that had Lincoln's, face on it, his profile. And I thought to myself, well, would Lincoln cry right now? Would this great man cry because he banged his head? And in my little mind, I thought, no, he wouldn't do that. So I took some deep breaths, and I realized from that point out, if I took deep breaths, that I could have sensations like pain sort of pass. And when I crawled out from under the table, my mom saw my head, and I told her what I did. I told her what I did. I don't know what she thought of that. Told her, I said, okay, Mom, I'm like Abraham Lincoln. So I learned at those places, those are the stages where I learned that how I thought and believed would change the way I was feeling. And I also learned about how my body was involved in my feelings. And I learned that breathing and controlling my breathing or doing something with my breath would help me. So that was my intimations. And so when you have those kind of personal experiences, by the time you start to read about them and start to understand them in another context, it's like you just feel like you belong. My next experience was when we lived in Somerset, Pennsylvania, and we used to go to a 5 and dime store. And my mom would collect stamps. And they had these, I don't know if any of you watching or listening remember, but we had these... Green stamps, right? And you'd get a book and you'd put a stamp in and you'd collect stamps, and then they had things that you could get if you got so many stamps. They had bicycles and they had plates and they had everything else you can imagine. Well, I loved that store. And I loved going to the comic book rack. That's where I lived. Those comic book racks that spun and they were filled with comics, that's where I lived. I would just sit there and enjoy myself. But I remember one time, on another rack beside the comics, there was a rack full of sunglasses. And so I got up and I was trying on different sunglasses. And I remember looking into the mirror. And like I said, these kind of experiences changed me. And I had this sense. I had this sense that this wasn't my true nature. That this wasn't the real me. That somehow I was observing or seeing beyond that. And I knew in my heart and mind and my gut, I knew that this was not my true self. That this would not last. But that was never born and that would never die. So those were some experiences as a kid. And then when I was in my early 20s, I was driving back and forth a lot from Virginia, down near Virginia Beach where I was working, and Williamsburg. And I was dating my wife then, so I was driving back on the weekends, which was about 8.5 hour drive, so that I'd have the joy of being able to spend maybe 5 hours with her, because her parents were a bit traditional. So I could come and see her, and we'd hang out at her house, and then I'd drive back the next day. I didn't mind at all. And I'd do it again. But one of the things that happened to me, and I'm not going to go into great detail, but basically I went off the road and got stranded on the mountain between, I forget the name of the exit. Do you remember the name of the exit there? I'm asking my wife.
You mean Bedford?
Well, it's not Bedford, it's the other exit before you get to Bedford.
Breezewood.
And it was somewhere, I was trying to get up over the mountain. And anyhow, my car went off the road and I got stuck down in the woods a bit. And it was that big storm. I don't know what year that was. You remember what year that was? It was like 80, was it 83? Something like that, 84? It's this huge storm. It was historical. We called it one of the great storms. And so the snow was coming down like crazy. But essentially, I was going to try to get out of the car, but I couldn't, because I couldn't open the door the whole way. And the snow was coming down so much you were completely snowblind. And there was nothing around. I mean, there was nothing around for miles. So my thought was, okay, I'm just gonna stay in the car and hopefully it'll stop snowing and someone will come along. And I was wearing shorts and a sweatshirt because I was a young guy and I wore shorts in the summer. And or the winter, and so I put my blanket, I have this tiger blanket that I love, and I put it over me and put it over my head because the car, you know, I was afraid to keep it running too long because it was no room for the pipe. And so as the last strains of the Who 8-track went out, I was not quite sure what was going to happen. I wasn't sure I was going to make it. And by this time, everything was frozen. The doors were frozen. I couldn't get out. So I put the blanket over my head and I did the breathing, right? Because I'd been studying martial arts since the age of 10. And so I started doing this kind of breathing. And then I faded. And I don't really know what happened that night. I don't know if, you know, people say, did you have a near-death experience? Did you die? I don't think so. But I had a very profound out-of-body experience. I had two things happen to me. I was no longer in my body. I rose above my body. I could see myself laying there. And I had two awarenesses. One was, I had an awareness of, I can't say it anything more than another being sort of watching over me. It wasn't human, but it was like, some being watching over me. And then I had the sensation of being drawn up into the sky and my body moving very rapidly. And then at one point, I became conscious of a small house in the woods, and I felt myself drawn to it. And I went through the rafters, and I remember I could just travel any way that I wanted. And I remember there was a man and a woman, and there was a baby in a crib, and the baby was screaming and crying, and the man and the woman were just screaming at each other. And it was such a frightening scene. And I kept trying to speak to them. I kept trying to implore them to stop fighting, to think of the child. And then after a bit, I felt myself being drawn back up into the sky. And then I found myself again flying through space. And the next thing I remember was that I woke up and it was dark because of the blanket, but it was light and it was like the next morning. and it had stopped snowing. And the blanket was frozen. It was like when I pulled it off, it cracked and there was ice all inside. And so anyhow, I got out of that. I was able to get out, and there was a plow truck that was able to give me a ride. I did get severe frostbite from that experience. So I don't know if I died or not, but I definitely had an out-of-body experience. It was very, very vivid to me and very, very clear. And so those two experiences, the one when I was a boy, and then the one with the mountain in the winter there, I just knew that this experience I'm having right now, this physical form, is not my true nature. It's not my true self. And I never had a big fear of death because of that connection. So I just want to, because I don't want to go on too much in these experiences, because I want to get to the heart of why it matters to you. So just like with the mindfulness and the breathing, I learned to apply those in my daily life by realizing that my thoughts are what, my beliefs are what create my experience of the world. And I realized that I couldn't always change the outer world to accommodate me, but I could always change from within. And I realized that my body and my mind were connected. And so that encouraged me to practice meditation. And I realized that my true self, my true nature, was not this body and not this personal story or drama. That I was connected to the eternal, and that was something that was undying and unborn. And the way that I practice that sense of calling is that I know that if I start every day, the first thing I do when I become awake and conscious is that I take refuge in that true self. And I do that practice, and I do that before I go to sleep, I know everything will be okay. It won't matter what happens. I will be all right because I belong and I'm connected. And when I had other experiences, I'll mention them briefly. One was when I found out that my wife was pregnant and I found out that I was going to have a son. I was pulling up to a bank drive-through, and I was in our old Pontiac Sunbird with a sunroof. And I remember looking up through that sunroof and suddenly having this huge experience of knowing that, wow, I was now a part of it all. Because there was a part of me that felt sort of separate from others. But now I had this being who was going to be my responsibility, and it was going to be part of my being, my flesh. And now I'm a part of the whole thing, man. I'm a part of the whole mess. So whatever happens in the world, you know what? It's kind of my issue too now, because I'm connected. And so that was a deep sense of that. The other was we lived on a farm in Evansburg. I won't go into details of it, but I had this incredible experience sitting in meditation for hours and hours. And I saw what I can only describe as seeing the past deep and deep into the primordial past, and understanding how all those things sort of came together. And so I've had those kind of experiences. And I've found that no matter what's going on in my life, no matter how difficult things may be sometimes, that it's that connection. It's that connection to oneness. It's that connection, that very personal connection, that relationship, that is what allows me to stay centered. That is what allows me to stay grounded. And I can't imagine living without it. I can't imagine what life is like for those who just get up and get going. And they have no sense of that connection, no sense of that abiding oneness. To me, that would be hell. And I close the chapter with an experience I had when I was working as a chaplain at the hospital, And we would get vaccines, and we had to get all these vaccines. And one of these vaccines nearly killed me. And it actually left me with a permanent problem in terms of my immune system. But, you know, we had to take them, and I took it, and I ended up in the hospital, and it was just a terrible experience. I mean, one of those painful experiences physically. I had high fevers. I was racked with pain. I don't remember a lot of it. But when I got out of it, it left a lot of, it's messed with my nervous system and my immune system, and so it took me a while to recover. But one of the things it did do that came out of that, because it was definitely a hell realm after that for a long time, I realized that I had to find a way to make the teachings not just philosophical, but something that could be applied therapeutically. And while this has always been a part of the Buddhist tradition, it was something that I had found to some degree had kind of gotten pushed back, and that the philosophical aspects had become to the fore. And I wanted to bring back that psychotherapeutic essence that was there from the beginning. And so that's when I started to create. I had started creating it, but that's when I started to formulate in a real way the four-direction system of mindfulness that we use in the Dragonfly Song. So I just share that because I want you to know that you too can have that kind of personal experience. You shouldn't go chasing it, but if you prime your pump, the water's there. But if you don't prime that pump, all that water's there, that reservoir is there, but you won't have any contact with it. So you gotta prime that pump. And part of that is study, understanding oneness, understanding the three principles of oneness, and then the practice of meditation and liturgy, that allowing yourself to find that daily devotional that allows you to have that contact, that personal relationship with the ground of your very being. And so that priming is the precepts, meditation, mindfulness, understanding all these things. So I encourage you to do that, because when you do, it will change your life. You will lose your fear of death. You will suffer less. And you will create more. And you will be far more understanding and compassionate and far less judgmental or self-righteous. So, I encourage you to have your own personal experiences of oneness.